It stars Mike Baldwin, or the actor Johnny Briggs, who plays the cunt in Coronation Street. It's like a carry-on film with less humour and mere sex. Mike eventually gets fucked, but he doesn't deserve to, looking like an irritating wee sleazebag for most of the film. I keep drifting off into a delirious sleep and waking with a start, my head jerking back like it's going to snap off my shooters. Out of the corner of my eye, I see a guy moving seats to sit next to us. He puts his hand on my thigh. I pull his hand off. Get the fuck. You want your head and hands to play with, you cunt. Sorry. Sorry, he says in a European accent. He's an old cunt and all. He sounds really pathetic and he's got a wizened wee face. I actually start feeling sorry for him. I'm no a bufty pal, I tell him. He looks confused. No homosexual, I point at myself, feeling vaguely ridiculous. What a fucking daft thing to say. Sorry. Sorry. This sort of gets us thinking. How the fuck do I ken I'm no a homosexual if I've never been with another guy? I mean, really, for sure. I've always had a notion to go all the way with another guy to see what it was like. I mean, you've got to try everything once. Having said that, I'd have to be in the driving seat. I couldn't handle some cunt's knob up my arse. One time I picked up this gorgeous young queen in the London Apprentice. I took him back to the old gaff in Poplar. Tony and Caroline came in and caught us geeing the boy a gam. It was a total embarrassment. Geeing a guy who was wearing a condom a blowjob, it was like sucking a plastic dildo. I was bored to fuck, but the boy had sucked me off first, so I felt I had to reciprocate. It was a good blowjob he gave, technically speaking. However, I had kept going soft and collapsing with laughter at the expression on his face. He looked like this lassie I used to fancy ages ago, so with a bit of imagination and concentration, I managed, to my surprise, to shoot my load into the rubber. I took a real slagging for Tony for this episode, but Caroline thought it was cool, and confessed to us that she was as jealous as fuck. She thought the guy was a honey. Anyway, I wouldn't mind going all the way with a gadge if it felt right, just for the experience. Problem is, I only really fancy birds. Guys just didn't look sexy. It's all about aesthetics. Fuck all to do with morality. The old cunt doesn't exactly look like he'd be high on the list of candidates to lose your homosexual virginity to. He tells us, though, that he's got a place up in Stoke Newington and asks us if I'd like to crash the night. Well, Stokey's no far from Mel's bit at Dalston, so I thought, fuck it. The old cunt's Italian, and he's called G, short for Giovanni, I'd imagine. He tells us that he's working in a restaurant and that he's got a wife and bairns back in Italy. I get a feeling that this doesn't quite ring true. One of the great things about being into junk is that you come across loads of liars. You develop a certain expertise in that area yourself and a keen nose for the bullshit. We get a night bus up to Stokey for Victoria. There's loads of young punters on the bus, stoned, pished, gone to parties, coming for parties. I wish to fuck that I was in one of these squads instead of with this old cunt. Still, G's basement flat is somewhere off of Church Street. I'm lost after that, but I ken that we're nose as far in as Newington Green. It's extremely fucking dingy inside. There's an old sideboard, a chest of drawers, and a big brass bed in the middle of this musty-smelling room, which has a kitchen and toilet off it. Given my previous vibe about this cunt, I'm surprised to see pictures of a woman and bairns all over the place. Your family, mate? Yes, this is my family. Soon they will be joining me. This still didn't sound plausible to me. Perhaps I've become too used to lies that the truth sounds indecently false. But still, must miss them. Yes, oh yes, he goes. Then he says, lie down on the bed, my friend. You can sleep. I like you. You can stay for a while. I give the wee cunt a hard stare. He's no physical threat, so I thought, fuck it, I'm knackered. And I climbed onto the bed. I had a flickery doubt as I remembered Dennis Nielsen. I bet there was some cunts we thought that he was no physical threat before he throttled them, decapitated them, and biled their heads in a big pan. Nielsen used to work in the same job centre in Cricklewood as this guy for Greenock I knew. The Greenock guy told me that one Christmas, Nielsen brought in a curry he'd made for the staff of the centre. Maybe bullshit, but you never know. Anyway, I'm so fucked that I shut my eyes, succumbing to my tiredness. I tensed slightly when I felt him getting onto the bed beside us, but I soon relaxed, because he made no move to touch us, and we were both fully clothed. I felt myself drifting off into a sick, disorientated sleep. I woke up, with no idea how long I'd been asleep. My mouth dried out in a strange wet sensation on my face. I touched the side of my cheek. Egg-white strands of thick, sticky fluid trailed from my hand. I turned and saw the old cunt lying beside us, now naked, spunk dripping for his small, fat cock. You dirty old cunt! Wanking over us in my fucking sleep, you fucking minging old bastard! I felt like a dirty hanky, just used, just nothing. A rage gripped us and I smacked the wee cunt in the mouth and pulled him off the bed. He looked like a repulsive fat gnome with his bloated stomach and ruined head. I booted him a few times as he cowered on the deck, then I stopped as I realised he was sobbing. Fuck's sake, dirty wee cunt, fucking! I paced up and down the room. His greeting was disturbing. Maria! Antonio! He sobs. I realise that I've got my ear marooned a wee bastard and I'm comforting him. It's all right, mate. It's all right. Sorry. Didn't he mean to hurt you. It's just like, see, no cunts wanked over us before. That was certainly true.
You are kind. What can I do? Maria! My Maria!
He was howling. His mouth dominated his face, a huge black hole in the twilight. He smelt his stale drink, sweat and spunk. Look, come on, we'll go down to a cafe. Have a wee blether. I'll get you some breakfast. On me. There's a good place down Ridley Road by the market, Ken. It'll be open by now. My suggestion was as much motivated by self-interest as altruism. It took us nearer to Mel's place at Dalston, and I wanted out of this depressing basement room. He got dressed and we left. We padded the hoof down Stokey High Street and Kingsland Road, down to the market. The cafe was surprisingly busy, but we got a table. I had a cheese and tomato bagel, and the old cunt has this horrible black boiled meat, the stuff that the Jewish punters up at Stamford Hill seem to be into. The cunt starts gabbing about Italy. He was married to this Maria woman for years. The family found out that him and Antonio, Maria's younger brother, were fucking each other. I shouldn't really put it like that, mere like that they were lovers. I think he loved the guy, but he loved Maria and all. I thought I was bad with drugs, but the mess some cunts make of their lives with love, it doesn't bear thinking about. Anyway, there was two other brothers, macho, Catholic, and according to G, involved with the Neapolitan Camorra. These cunts couldn't handle this. They got a hoodie G outside the family restaurant. They kicked 10 types of shit out of the pair wee cunt. Antonio got the same treatment later on. Antonio topped his cell after that. It means a lot in that culture, G tell us, to be disgraced in that way. I'm thinking it means a lot in any fucking culture. G then tells us that Antonio flung his cell in front of a train. I thought, maybe it does mean mayor in that culture after all. G fled to England, where he's been working in various Italian restaurants, living in seedy gaffs, drinking too much, exploiting or being exploited by the young guys and old wifeys he picks up. It sounds a pretty miserable life. My spirits soared when we got down the road to Mel's and I heard reggae music blasting into the street and saw the lights on. The fag end of what must have been a considerable party was still gone. It was good to get amongst old faces. They were all there, all the cunts, Davo, Susie, Nixie, bombed out his box, and Charlene. Bodies were crashed out all over the place. Two lassies were dancing with each other, and Char was dancing with this guy. Paul and Nixie were smoking, opium, no hash. Maced English junkies I know smoke horse rather than shoot it up. Needles seemed to be merely a Scottish Edinburgh thing. I take a talk for the cunts anyway. "Fucking great to see you again, me old son," Nixie slaps us on the back. Clocking G whispers, "Who's the old cunt then, eh?" I'd brought the wee bastard along. I didn't have the heart to leave the cunt after listening to all his tales of woe. "Sound, mate, great to see you. This is G. Good mate of mine's, stays up in Stokey." I slaps old G on the back. The pair wee fucker wears an expression like you'd see on a rabbit at the bars of its cage, asking for a bit of lettuce. I go for a wander, leaving G talking to Paul and Nixie about Napoli, Liverpool and West Ham, the international male language of football. Sometimes I lap up that talk, other times its pointless tediousness depresses the fuck out of us. In the kitchen, two guys are arguing about the poll tax. One boy's sussed out, the other's a fucking spineless Labour Tory Party servile wank boy. "You're a fucking arsehole on two counts. One, if you think the Labour Party's got a fucking chance of ever getting in again this century. Two, if you think it would make a blind bit of fucking difference if they ever did." I just butt in and tell the cunt. He stands there, open-mouthed, while the other guy smiles.
"That's just what I was trying to tell the bastard," he says in a Brummy accent.
I split, leaving the servile cunt still bemused. I go into a bedroom where this guy's licking out this lassie about 3 feet away from where some junkies are using. I look at the junkies. Fuck me, they're using works, shooting up in that. So much for my theories.
"You want a photograph, mate?"
The skinny wee goth wido who's cooking asks. "You want a fucking bus mouth cunt?" I answer his question with a question. He looks away and keeps cooking. I stare at the top of his head for a bit. Content that the cunt shat his load, I loosen up. Whenever I go down south, I seem to have that kind of attitude. It goes after a couple of days. I think I ken why I have it, but it would take too long to explain and sound too pathetic. As I leave the room, I hear the lassie groaning on the bed and the guy saying,
"What a fucking sweet cunt you got, girl."
I stagger through the door with that soft, slow voice resonating in my ear.
"What a fucking sweet cunt you got, girl."
And it starkly makes explicit to me just what I've been looking around for. I'm not exactly spoiled for choice here. The scene's pish poor in the potential bag off steaks. At this time of the morning, the most desirable women have either bagged off or fucked off. Charlene's copped, so's the woman that sick boy shagged on her 21st birthday. Even the lassie with the eyes like Marty Feldman and the hair like pubes is spoken for. Story of my fucking life. Arrive too early, get too pished, or stoned out of boredom and blow it, or get there too fucking late. Wee G's standing by the fireplace, sipping a can of lager. He looks frightened and bemused. I think to myself, I might end up whapping it up the wee cunt's chalk box yet. The thought depresses the fuck out of us. Still, we're all slags on holiday. Chapter 25. Bad Blood. I first met Alan Venters through the HIV and Positive self-help group, although he wasn't part of that group for long. Venters didn't look after himself very well, and soon developed one of the many opportunistic infections we're prone to. I always find the term opportunistic infection amusing. In our culture, it seems to invoke some admirable quality. I think of the opportunism of the entrepreneur who spots a gap in the market, or that of the striker in the penalty box. Tricky buggers, those opportunistic infections. The members of the group were in a roughly similar medical condition. We were all antibody positive, but still largely asymptomatic. Paranoia was never far from the surface at our meetings. Everybody seemed to be furtively checking out everyone else's lymph glands for signs of swelling. It was disconcerting to feel people's eyes stray to the side of your face during conversation. This type of behaviour added further to the sense of unreality which hung over me at the time. I really couldn't conceive of what had happened to me. The test results at first just seemed unbelievable, so incongruous with the healthy way I felt and looked. Part of me remained convinced that there had to be a mistake, in spite of taking the test 3 times. My self-delusion should have been shattered when Donna refused to see me, but it was always hanging on in the background with a grim resolution. We always seem to believe what we want to believe. I stopped going to the group meetings after they put Alan Venters in the hospice. It just depressed me, and anyway, I wanted to spend my time visiting him. Tom, my key worker and one of the group counsellors, reluctantly accepted my decision. "Look, Dave, I think that you seeing Alan in hospital is really great for him. I'm more concerned about you at the moment, though. You're in great health, and the purpose of the group is to encourage us to make the most of things. We don't stop living just because we're HIV positive." Poor Tom. His first faux pas of the day. "Is that the royal we, Tom? When you're HIV positive, tell me all about it." Tom's healthy pink cheeks flushed. He couldn't help it. Years of intensive interpersonal skills practice had taught him to hide the nervy visual and verbal giveaways. No shifty eye contact or quavering voice from him in the face of embarrassment. Not old Tom. Unfortunately, Tom canny do a thing about the glowing red smears which rush up the side of his face on such occasions. "I'm sorry," Tom apologised assertively. He had the right to make mistakes. He always said that people had that right. Try telling that to my damaged immune system. "I'm just concerned that you're choosing to spend your time with Alan. Watching him wasting away won't be good for you, and besides, Alan was hardly the most positive member of the group. He was certainly the most HIV positive member." Tom chose to ignore my remark. He had a right not to respond to the negative behaviour of others. We all had such a right, he told us. I liked Tom. He ploughed a lonely furrow, always trying to be positive. I thought that my job, which involved watching slumbering bodies being opened up by the cruel scalpel of Howson, was depressing and alienating. It's a veritable picnic, however, compared to watching souls being wrenched apart. That was what Tom had to put up with at the group meetings. Most members of the HIV and positive were intravenous drug users. They picked up HIV from the shooting galleries which flourished in the city in the mid-80s, after the Bread Street surgical suppliers were shut down. That stopped the flow of fresh needles and syringes. After that, it was large communal syringes and share alike. I've got a mate called Tommy who started using smack through hanging around with these guys in Leith. One of them I know, a guy called Mark Renton, whom I worked with way back in my chippy days. It's ironic that Mark has been shooting smack for years and is, so far as I know, still not infected with HIV, while I've never touched this stuff in my life. There were, however, enough smackheads present in the group to make you realise that he could be the exception rather than the rule. Group meetings were generally tense affairs. The junkies resented the two homosexuals in the group. They believed that HIV originally spread into the city's drug-using community through an exploitative, buffety landlord who fucked his sick junkie tenants for the rent. Myself and two women, one the non-drug-using partner of a junk addict, resented everyone as we were neither homosexual nor junkies. At first I, like everyone else, believed that I had been innocently infected. It was all too easy to blame the smackheads or the buffety boys at that time. However, I had seen the posters and read the leaflets. I remember in the punk era, the Sex Pistols saying that no one is innocent. Too true. What else has to be said, though, is that some are more guilty than others. This brings me back to Venters. I gave him a chance. A chance to show repentance. This was a sight more than the bastard deserved. At a group session, I told the first of several lies, the trail of which would lead to my grip on the soul of Alan Venters. I told the group that I had had unprotected, penetrative sex with people, knowing full well that I was HIV positive, and that I now regretted it. The room went deathly silent. People shifted nervously in their seats. Then a woman called Linda began to cry, shaking her head. Tom asked her if she wanted to leave the meeting. She said no, she would wait and hear what people had to say, venomously addressing her reply in my direction. I was largely oblivious to her anger, though. I never took my eyes off Venters. He had that characteristic, perpetually bored expression on his face. I was sure a faint smile briefly played across his lips. "That was a very brave thing to say, Davy. I'm sure it took a lot of courage," Tom said solemnly. "Not really, you dust prick. It was a fucking lie." I shrugged. "I'm sure a terrific burden of guilt has been lifted from you," Tom continued, raising his brows, inviting me to come in. I accepted the opportunity this time. "Yes, Tom. Just to be able to share it with you all, it's terrible. I don't expect people to forgive." The other woman in the group, Marjorie, directed a sneering insult towards me, which I didn't quite catch, while Linda continued crying. No reaction was forthcoming from the cunt who sat in the chair opposite me. His selfishness and lack of morality sickened me. I wanted to take him apart with my bare hands there and then. I fought to control my senses, savouring the richness of my plan to destroy him. The disease could have his body. That was its victory. Whatever malignant force it was, mine would be a greater one, a more crushing one. I wanted his spirit. I planned to carve mortal wounds into his supposedly everlasting soul. Amen. Tom looked around the circle. "Does anyone empathize with Davy? How do people feel about this?" After a bout of silence, during which my eyes stayed trained on the impassive figure of Venters, wee Gogsy, a junkie in the group, started to croak nervously. Then he blurted out in a terrible rant what I'd been waiting for from Venters. "I'm glad Davy says that. I did the same. I did the fucking same. An innocent lassie that never did a fucking thing to nobody. I just hated the world. I mean, I thought, how the fuck should I care? What have I got for life? I'm 23 and I've had nothing, not even a fucking job. Why should I care?" When I tell the lassie, she just freaked. He sobbed like a child. Then he looked up at us and produced, through his tears, the most beautiful smile I have ever seen on anyone in my life. "But it was all right. She took the test. 3 times our 6 months.
Nothing. She wasn't infected.
Marjorie, who in the same circumstances was infected, hissed at us. Then it happened. That cunt Venters rolled his eyes and smiled at me. That did it. That was the moment. The anger was still there, but it was fused with a great calmness, a powerful clarity. I smiled back at him, feeling like a semi-submerged crocodile eyeing a soft furry animal drinking at the river's edge.
No!
Wee Gogsy whined piteously at Marjorie.
It wasn't like that. Waiting for her test results was worse than waiting for mine. You still don't understand, I didn't... It's no like...
Tom came to the aid of the quivering, inarticulate mass he had become. Let's not forget the tremendous anger, resentment and bitterness that you all felt when you learned that you were antibody positive. This was the cue for one of our customary, ongoing series of arguments to shunt into full gear. Tom saw it as dealing with our anger by confronting reality. The process was supposed to be therapeutic, and indeed it seemed to be for many of the group, but I found it exhausting and depressing. Perhaps this was because, at the time, my personal agenda was different. Throughout this debate on personal responsibility, Venters, as was typical on such occasions, made his customary helpful and enlightening contribution.
Shite! He exclaimed.
Whenever someone made a point with passion, Tom would ask him, as he always did, why he felt that way.
Just do,
Venters replied with a shrug. Tom asked if he could explain why.
It's just one person's view against the others.
Tom responded by asking Alan what his view was. Alan either said, I'm no bothered, or I didn't give a fuck. I forget his exact words. Tom then asked him why he was here. Venter said,
I'll go then.
He left, and the atmosphere instantly improved. It was as if someone who had done a vile and odious fart had somehow sucked it back up their arsehole. He came back, though, as he always did, sporting that sneering, gloating expression. It was as if Venters believed that he alone was immortal. He enjoyed watching others trying to be positive, then deflating them. Never blatantly enough to get kicked out of the group, but enough to significantly lower its morale. The disease which racked his body was a sweetheart compared to the more obscure one that possessed his sick mind. Ironically, Venters saw me as a kindred spirit, unaware that my sole purpose of attending the meetings was to scrutinise him. I never spoke in the group and perfected a cynical look whenever anyone else did. Such behaviour provided the basis on which I was able to pal up with Alan Venters. It had been easy to befriend this guy. Nobody else wanted to know him. I simply became his friend by default. We started drinking together, him recklessly, me carefully. I began to learn about his life, accumulating knowledge steadily, thoroughly, and systematically. I had done a degree in chemistry at Strathclyde University, but I never approached my studies of that subject with anything like the rigour or enthusiasm with which I approached the study of Venters. Venters had got HIV infection, like most people in Edinburgh, through the sharing of needles while taking heroin. Ironically, prior to being diagnosed HIV positive, he had kicked the junk, but was now a hopeless pisshead. The way he drank indiscriminately, occasionally stuffing a pub roll or toasty into his face during a marathon drinking bout, meant that his weakened frame was easy prey to all sorts of potentially killer infections. During his period of socialising with me, I confidently prophesied that he would last no time. That was how it turned out. A number of infections were soon coursing through his body. This made no difference to him. Venters carried on behaving as he had always done. He started to attend the hospice, or the unit, as they called it, first as an outpatient, then with a berth of his very own. It always seemed to be raining when I made that journey to the hospice. A wet, freezing, persistent rain, with winds that cut through your layers of clothing like an X-ray. Chills equal colds, and colds can equal death, but this meant little to me at the time. Now, of course, I look after myself. Then, however, I had an all-consuming mission. There was work to be done. The hospice building is not unattractive. They've faced over the grey blocks with some nice yellow brickwork. There is no yellow brick approach road to the place, however. Every visit to Alan Venter's brought my last one and my final revenge closer to hand. The point soon came when there was no time left to try and elicit heartfelt apologies from him. At one stage, I thought that I wanted repentance from Venters more than revenge for myself. If I got it, I would have died with a belief in the fundamental goodness of the human spirit. The shriveled vessel of skin and bone which contained the life force of Venters seemed to be an inadequate home for a spirit of any sorts, let alone one in which to invest your hopes for humanity. However, a weakened, decaying body was supposed to bring the spirit closer to the surface and make it more apparent to we mortals. That is what Gillian from the hospital where I worked told me. Gillian is very religious, and it suits her to believe that. We all see what we want to see. What did I really want? Perhaps it was always revenge rather than repentance. Venters could have babbled for forgiveness like a greeting-faced bairn. It might not have been enough to stop me from doing what I planned to do. This internal discoursing, it's a byproduct of all that counselling I got from Tom. He emphasised basic truths. You're not dying yet, you have to live your life until you are. Underpinning them was the belief that the grim reality of impending death can be talked away by trying to invest in the present reality of life. I didn't believe that at the time, but now I do. By definition, you have to live until you die. Better to make that life as complete and enjoyable an experience as possible in case death is shite, which I suspect it will be. The nurse at the hospital looked a bit like Gail, a woman I'd once gone out with, pretty disastrously as it happens. She wore the same cool expression on her face. In her case, she had good reason, as I recognised it as one of professional concern. In Gail's case, such detachment was, I feel, inappropriate. This nurse looked at me in that strained, serious and patronising way. "Alan's very weak. Please don't stay too long." "I understand," I smiled, benign and sombre. As she was playing the caring professional, I thought that I had better play the concerned friend. I seemed to be playing the part quite well. "He's very fortunate to have such a good friend," she said, obviously perplexed that such a bastard abomination could have any friends. I grunted something non-committal and moved into the small room. Alan looked terrible. I was worried sick, gravely concerned that this bastard might not last the week, that he might escape from the terrible destiny I'd carved out for him. The timing had to be right. It had given me great pleasure at the start to witness Venter's great physical agony. I will never let myself get into a state like that when I get sick. Fuck that. I'll leave that engine running in the lock-up garage. Venter's, shite that he is, did not have the guts to leave the gig of his own accord. He'd hang on till the grim end, if only to maximise the inconvenience to everyone. "All right, Al?" I asked him. A silly question, really, Convention always imposes its lunacy on us at such inappropriate times.
Not bad, he wheezed. Are you quite sure, Alan, dear boy? Nothing wrong? You look a bit peaky. Probably just a touch of this little bug that's doing the rounds. Straight to bed with a couple of Disprins and you'll be right as rain tomorrow. Any pain? I ask, hopefully. No. They got drugs. Just my breathing.
I held his hand and felt a twinge of amusement as his pathetic, bony fingers squeezed tightly. I thought I was going to laugh at his skeletal face as his tired eyes kept shutting.
Alas, poor Alan. I knew him, nurse. He was a wanker, an infinite pest.
I watched, stifling smirks, as he groped for breath.
It's all right, mate. I'm here, I said. You're a good guy, Davy, he spluttered. Pity we never knew each other before this.
He opened his eyes and shut them again.
What's a fucking pity, all right, you trash-faced little cunt?
I hissed at his closed eyes.
What? What was that?
He was delirious with fatigue and drugs.
Lazy cunt. Spends too long in that scratcher. Should get off his hole for a wee bit of exercise. A quick jog around the park. 50 press-ups. 24 squat thrusts.
I said it's a shame we had to meet under such circumstances. He groaned contentedly and fell into a sleep. I extracted his scrawny fingers from my hand.
Unpleasant dreams, cunt.
The nurse came in to check on my man. Most antisocial, hardly the way to treat a guest, I smiled, looking down on the slumbering near corpse that was Venters. She forced a nervous laugh, probably thinking it's the black humour of the homosexual, or the junkie, or the haemophiliac, or whatever she imagines me to be. I don't give a toss about her perception of me. I see myself as the avenging angel. Killing this shitebag would only do him a big favour. That was the problem, but one which I managed to resolve. How do you hurt a man who's going to die soon, knows it, and doesn't give a toss? Talking, but more crucially, listening to Venters, I found out how. You hurt them through the living, through the people they care for. The song says that everybody loves somebody sometime. But Venters seemed to defy that generalisation. The man just did not like people, and they more than reciprocated. With other men, Venters saw himself in an adversarial role. Past acquaintances were described with bitterness, a rip-off merchant, or derision, a fucking sap. The description employed depended on who had abused, exploited, or manipulated whom, on the particular occasion in question. Women fell into two indistinct categories. Either they had a fanny like a fish supper, or a fanny like a burst couch. Venters evidently saw little in a woman beyond the furry hole, as he called it. Even some disparaging remarks about their tits or arses would have represented a considerable broadening of vision. I got despondent. How could this bastard ever love anybody? I gave it time, however, and patience reaped its reward. Despicable shite though he was, Venters did care for one person. There was no mistaking the change in his conversational tone when he employed the phrase, "the wee felly." I discreetly pumped him for information about the 5-year-old son he had by this woman in Wester Hills, a cow, who would not let him see the child, named Kevin. Part of me loved this woman already. The child showed me how Venters could be hurt. In contrast to his normal bearing, he was stricken with pain and incoherent with sentiment when he talked about how he'd never see his son grow up, about how much he loved the wee felly. That was why Venters did not fear death. He actually believed that he would live on, in some sense or other, through his son. It hadn't been difficult to insinuate myself into the life of Frances, Venter's ex-girlfriend. She hated Venters with a vitriol which endeared her to me, even though I wasn't attracted to her in any other way. After checking her out, I cruised her, accidentally on purpose, at a trashy disco, where I played the role of charming and attentive suitor. Of course, money was no object. She was soon well into it, obviously having never been treated decently by a man in her life, and she wasn't used to cash, living on the breadline with a kid to bring up. The worst part of it was when it came to sex. I insisted, of course, on wearing a condom. She had, prior to us getting to that stage, told me about Venters. I nobly said that I trusted her and would be prepared to make love without a condom, but I wanted to remove the element of uncertainty from her mind, and I had to be honest, I had been with a few different people. Given her past experience with Venters, such doubts were bound to be present. When she started to cry, I thought I'd blown it. Her tears were due to gratitude, however.
"You're a really nice person, David, you ken that?" she said.
If she knew what I was going to do, she wouldn't have held such a lofty opinion. It made me feel bad, but whenever I thought of Venters, the feeling evaporated. I would go through with it all right. I timed my courtship of Frances to coincide with Venter's decline into serious illness and his attendant incapacity in the hospice. A number of illnesses were in the frame to finish Venter's, the leader of the field being pneumonia. Venter's, in common with a lot of HIV-infected punters who take the junk route, escaped the horrible skin cancers more prevalent amongst gays. The main rival to his pneumonia was the prolific thrush, which went into his throat and stomach. Thrush was not the first thing to want to choke the living shit out of the bastard, but it could be the last, unless I moved quickly. His decline was very rapid, at one stage too rapid for my liking. I thought that the cunt would cash in his chips before I could execute my plan. My opportunity came, in the event, at exactly the right time. In the end, it was probably 50-50 luck and planning. Venters was struggling, no more than a wrinkled parcel of skin and bone. The doctor had said, "Any day now." I had got Frances to trust me with the babysitting. I encouraged her to get out with her friends. She was planning to go out for a curry on the Saturday night, leaving me alone in her flat with the kid. I would take the opportunity presented to me. On the Wednesday before the big day, I decided to visit my parents. I thought about telling them of my medical condition and knew it would probably be my last visit. My parents' home was a flat in Oxgangs. The place had always seemed so modern to me when I was a kid. Now it looked strange, a shantytown relic of a bygone era. The old girl answered the door. For a second she looked tentative. Then she realised it was me, and not my younger brother, and therefore the purse could be kept in mothballs. She welcomed me, her enthusiasm generated by relief.
"Hello, stranger," she sang, ushering me in with haste.
I noted the reason for the hurry. Coronation Street was on. Mike Baldwin had apparently reached a point where he had to confront live-in lover Alma Sedgwick and tell her that he was really into rich widow Jackie Ingram. Mike couldn't help it. He was a prisoner of love, a force external to him, which compelled him to behave the way he did. I could, as Tom would have put it, empathise. I was a prisoner of hate, a force which was an equally demanding taskmaster. I sat down on the couch.
"Hello, stranger," my old man repeated, not looking at me from behind his evening news. "What have you been up to then?" he asked wearily. "Nothing much.
"'Nothing really, Pater. "'Oh, did I mention I'm antibody positive? "'It's very fashionable now, you know. "'One simply must have a damaged immune system these days.'
2 million chinkies. 2 million of the buggers. That's what we're going to have over here when Hong Kong goes back to China.
He let out a long exhalation of breath.
2 million wee wally winkies, he mused.
I said nothing, refusing to rise to the bait. Ever since I'd gone to university, jacking in what my parents habitually described as a good trade, the old man had cast himself as hard-nosed reactionary to my student revolutionary. At first it had been a joke, but with the passing years I grew out of my role as he began to embrace his more firmly. "'You're a fascist. It's all to do with inadequate penis size,' I told him cheerfully. Coronation Street's vice-like grip on my ma's psyche was broken briefly as she turned to us with a knowing smirk.
"'Didn't he talk bloody nonsense? I've proved my manhood, son,' he belligerently replied,
digging at the fact I'd managed to reach the age of 25 without obtaining a wife or producing children. For a second, I even thought that he was going to pull out his cock to try and prove me wrong. Instead, he shrugged off my remark and returned to his chosen theme.
"'How do you like 2 million chinkies in your street?'
I thought of the term chinky and visualised loads of aluminium cartons of half-eaten food lying in my road. It was an easy image to call to mind, as it was a scene I observed every Sunday morning. "'It sometimes seems like I already have,' I thought out loud.
"'There you are, then,' he said, as if I'd conceded a point. "'Another 2 million are on their way. How'd you like that?'
Presumably the whole 2 million won't move into Caledonian Place. I mean, conditions are cramped enough in the Dalry ghetto as it is.
Laugh if you like. What about jobs? 2 million on the dole already. Hooses? Or they pair buggers living in Cardboard City?
God, was he nipping my heat. Thankfully, the mighty Ma, guardian of the soapbox, intervened.
Shut up, will yes. I'm trying to watch the telly.
"'Sorry, Mater, I know that it's a trifle self-indulgent of me, your HIV offspring, to crave your attention when Mike Baldwin is making an important choice which will determine his future. Which grotesque old hingute will the shrivelled postmenopausal slag want to shaft? Stay tuned!'
I decide not to mention my HIV. My parents don't have very progressive views on such things. Or maybe they do. Who knows? At any rate, it just did not feel right. Tom always tells us to keep in tune with our feelings. My feelings were that my parents married at 18 and had produced 4 screaming brats by the time they were my age. They think I'm queer already. Bringing AIDS into the picture will only serve to confirm this suspicion. Instead, I drank a can of export and quietly talked football with the old man. He hadn't been to a game since 1970. Colour television had gone for his legs. 20 years later, satellite came along and fucked them up completely. Nonetheless, he still regarded himself as an expert on the game. The opinions of others were worthless. In any event, it was a waste of time attempting to venture them. As with politics, he'd eventually come around to the opposite viewpoint from the one he'd previously advocated and express it just as stridently. All you needed to do was put up no hard front for him to argue against, and he'd gradually talk himself around to your way of thinking. I sat for a while, nodding intently. Then I made some banal excuse and left. I returned home and checked my toolbox. A former chippy's collection of various sharp implements. On Saturday, I took it round to Francis's flat in Wester Hills. I had a few odd jobs to do. One of them she knew nothing about. Fran had been looking forward to the meal out with her pals. She talked incessantly as she got ready. I tried to respond beyond a series of low groans which sounded like "aye" and "right," but my mind was spinning with thoughts of what I had to do. I sat hunched and tense on the bed, frequently rising to the window to peer out as she put her face on. After what seemed like a lifetime, I heard the sound of a motor rolling into the deserted, shabby car park. I sprang to the window, cheerfully announcing, "Taxi's here!" Frances left me in custody of her sleeping child. The whole operation went smoothly enough. Afterwards, I felt terrible. Was I any better than Venters? Wee Kevin. We had some good times together. I'd taken him to the shows at the Meadows Festival, to Kirkcaldy for a League Cup tie, and to the Museum of Childhood. While it doesn't seem a great deal, it's a sight more than his old boy ever did for the poor wee bastard. Frances said as much to me. Bad as I felt then, it was only a foretaste of the horror that hit me when I developed the photographs. As the prints formed into clarity, I shook with fear and remorse. I put them on the dryer and made myself a coffee, which I used to wash down to Valium. Then I took the prints and went to the hospice to visit Venters. Physically, there was not a great deal left of him. I feared the worst when I looked into his glazed eyes. Some people with AIDS have been developing pre-senile dementia. The disease could have his body if it had also taken his mind. It would deprive me of my revenge. Thankfully, Venters soon registered my presence. His initial lack of response, probably a side effect of the medication he was on. His eyes soon fixed me in their gaze, acquiring the sneaky, furtive look I associated with him. I could feel his contempt for me oozing through his sickly smile. He thought he'd found a sappy cunt to indulge him until the end. I sat with him, holding his hand. I felt like snapping off his scrawny fingers and sticking them into his orifices. I blamed him for what I had to do to Kevin, as well as all the other issues. "You're a good guy, Davy. Pity we didn't meet in different circumstances," he wheezed, repeating that well-worn phrase he used on all my visits. I tightened my grasp on his hand. He looked at me uncomprehendingly. Good. The bastard could still feel physical pain. It wasn't going to be that kind of pain which would hurt him, but it was a nice extra. I spoke in clear, measured tones. "I told you I got infected through shooting up, Al. Well, I lied. I lied to ye about tonsy things."
"What's all this, Davy?"
"Just listen for a minute, Al. I got infected through this bird I'd been seeing. She didn't ken that she was HIV. She got infected by a piece of shite that she met one night in a pub. She was a bit pished and a bit naive, this wee bird. Ken? This cunt says that he had a wee bit of dope back at his gaff, so she went with the cunt, back to his flat. The bastard raped her. You ken what he did, Al?"
"Davy, what is this?"
"I'll fucking tell ye. Threatened her with a fucking blade. Tied her doon. Fucked her fanny. Fucked her ass. Made her go doon on him. The lassie was terrified, as well as being hurt. Does this sound familiar then, cunt?"
I dinny ken what the fuck you're on about, Davy. Dinny fucking stat.
You remember Donna. You remember the Southern Bar.
I was fucked up, man. You remember what you says?"
"That was lies. Bullshit. I couldn't have got a fucking root on if I knew I had that shite in my cum. I couldn't have raised a fucking smile.
wee Gogsy. Mindy him.
Shut your fucking mouth.
Wee Gogsy took his fucking chance. You sat there like it was a fucking pantomime when you had yours.
I rasped, watching drops of my gob disseminate into the film of sweat which covered his shrunken coupon. I composed myself, continuing my story. The lassie went through a heavy time. She was strong-willed, though. It would have fucked up a lot of women, but Donna tried to shrug it off. Why let one spunk-gobbed cunt ruin your life? Easier said than done, but she did it. What she didn't ken was that the scumbag in question was HIV positive. Then she meets this other guy. They hit it off. He likes her, but he kens that she's got problems with men and sex. Nae fucking wonder, eh? I wanted to strangle the perverse force which passed the life out of the cunt's body. Not yet, I told myself. Not yet, you doss fucker! I drew a heavy breath and continued my tale, reliving the horror of it. They worked it out, this lassie and the other guy. Things were barry for a bit. Then she discovered that the rapist fuckbag was HIV. Then she discovered that she was. But what was worse for this person, a real person, a fucking moral person, was when she found out that her new felly was.
All because of you, the rapist cunt. Ah, was the new felly. Me, big fucking sap here.
I pointed to myself.
Davy, I'm sorry, man. What can I say? You've been a good mate. It's that disease. It's a fucking horrible disease, Davy. It kills the innocent, Davy. It kills the innocent.
It's too late for that shite now. You had your chance at the time, like wee Gogsy. He laughed in my face. It was a deep, wheezing sound.
So what are you? What are you going to do about it? Kill me? Go ahead. You'd be doing us a favour. I didn't give a fuck.
His wizened death mask seemed to become animated, to fill with a strange, ugly energy. This was not a human being. Obviously, it suited me to believe that, made it easier to do what I had to do, but in cold light of day, I believe it still. It was time to play my cards. I calmly produced the photographs from my inside pocket. It's not so much what I'm gonna do about it, mair what I already have done about it. I smiled, drinking the expression of perplexed fear which etched onto his face.
What's this? What do you mean?
I felt wonderful. Shockwaves tripped over him, his scrawny head oscillating as his mind grappled with his greatest fears. He looked at the photographs in terror, unable to make them out, wondering what dreadful secrets they held. Think of the worst possible thing I could do to make you pissed off, Al. Then multiply it by 1,000, and you're not even fucking close. I shook my head mournfully. I showed him a photograph of myself and Francis. We were posing confidently, casually displaying the arrogance of lovers in their first flush.
What the fuck?
He spluttered, trying pathetically to pull his scrawny frame up in the bed. I thrust my hand to his chest and effortlessly pushed him back home. I did this slowly, savouring my power and his impotence in that one gorgeous motion. Relax, Al, relax. Unwind. Loosen up a little. Take it easy. Remember what the doctors and nurses say.
You need your rest. I flipped the first photo over, exposing the next picture to him. That was Kevin that took the last picture.